this type of launch again. It is a violation of UN Security Council resolutions.
Talks and negotiations still available to North Korea. It's Tuesday, August 29th. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Join us too on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, China opens some access to Philippine fishers. The U.S. Navy seeks collision answers. Pakistan responds to terrorism. Global health programs facing budget cuts. Super fast Wi-Fi. It's all on today's VOA Asia. We begin with news that broke just a short time ago. South Korea's military saying North Korea fired a ballistic missile from its capital, Pyongyang, toward the sea between the Korean Peninsula and Japan. Seoul's Joint Chiefs of Staff on Tuesday said the South Korean and U.S. militaries were analyzing the launch and did not immediately confirm how far the projectile traveled and where it landed. Japanese public broadcaster NHK reported that the missile passed over northern Japan, broke into three pieces, and fell into waters off of Japan's Hokkaido. The Japanese government's J-Alert warning system advised people in the area to take precautions. Other reports say three separate missiles were fired. The North has also threatened to lob some of its missiles toward Guam and expressed anger over the ongoing annual war games between the United States and South Korea. Stay with VOA as the story continues to develop. Just a day earlier, U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said he still hopes to persuade North Korea to come to the negotiating table despite Saturday's launch of several short-range missiles off its east coast. Tillerson appeared on the Fox News Sunday program.
This type of launch, again, it is a violation of UN Security Council resolutions. So it is clearly they're still messaging us as well. That they are not prepared to completely back away from their position. Having said that, we're going to continue our peaceful pressure campaign, as I have described it, working with allies, working with China as well, to see if we can bring the regime in Pyongyang to the negotiating table with a view to begin a dialogue on a different future for Korean Peninsula and for North Korea.
Tillerson said he wants the Kim Jong-un regime to understand there is a different path it can choose. He said there is a unified international voice echoing the message that no one wants to see a nuclearized Korean peninsula, and engagement with Pyongyang would be aimed at achieving that. Bruce Bennett, defense analyst at the RAND Corporation, tells VOA's Victor Beatty Tillerson's peaceful pressure campaign has largely been waged through economic sanctions.
Because North Korea mainly builds its own missiles and nuclear weapons, it doesn't have much leverage on those programs directly, but it does impose pain on North Korea as a society under the hopes that Kim Jong-un will decide that it will be better for him to give up the provocative actions he's taking. Thus far, he's chosen that not to be the case, and now the U.S. administration is trying to determine what further it can do that would still be relatively peaceful to deal with North Korea.
In recent weeks, Kim Jong-un had threatened to launch missiles toward the U.S. Pacific Island territory of Guam. He has not been doing so, but now he's launched at least three short-range missiles. Were the President and Secretary of State Tillerson wrong in saying that perhaps Kim is showing some restraint?
Well, he certainly showed restraint in terms of not firing at Guam. The shorter-range missiles that he fired, we still don't know. We have not heard anything from the government about what kind they were. But some of the speculation is that they were really artillery missiles, missiles launched from a multiple rocket launcher. They're still guided missiles, and these could have been development tests because the missile that would likely have been used had only flown out to 200 kilometers before, and these missiles went out to about 250. But this was not a long-range test. It was not directly threatening the United States or even Japan. So I think the attitude has been a little bit more restrained this time from the U.S. side, saying, look, we really do want to get to negotiations, but we're prepared to turn up the heat if you don't act in a more reasonable manner.
China's Commerce Ministry on Friday banned North Korean individuals and enterprises from doing new business in China. Is that part of China's commitment to the latest UN Security Council resolution?
Oh, I think so. In fact, I think China wants to demonstrate very clearly to the world that it is not the problem, that it is doing what it can. Now, there's still a degree of corruption in the Chinese government, and so some trade is going to go on until they really lock down on the different Chinese groups that work around the normal trade limitations. But they're working on it. China's making an effort and trying to be responsive to the recent UN Security Council resolutions.
Bruce Bennett said he believes recent harsh U.S. rhetoric coupled with the most recent tough Security Council resolution appears to have persuaded North Korea it must take the global community's concerns about its nuclear and missile programs more seriously. These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on VOAnews.com. India and China reach agreement to end tense border standoff. Controversial Indian guru sentenced to 20 years in rape case. China reopens hotly disputed fishing spot to Philippine boats. Pakistan postpones U.S. visit after Trump speech. Samsung's Lee appeals bribery case ruling. Expanded coverage of these stories and much more are on Facebook at VOA Asia. And also stop by our VOAnews.com website. VOA Asia continues. Beijing is letting Philippine-registered fishing vessels access a disputed South China Sea shoal, once the centerpiece of a bitter bilateral dispute, in an apparent goodwill gesture that would help otherwise strained Chinese relations with Manila, as well as much of Southeast Asia. China has been allowing the boat since April into Scarborough Shoal, a 150-square-kilometer feature with a lagoon west of the Philippine island of Luzon, official and academic sources say. It's considered a prime fishing site. Yuan Graham is International Security Director at the Lowy Institute for International Policy in Sydney.
What's happened around Scarborough Shoal has been not widely reported, but the fact that you've had Philippine fishing vessels accessing the shoal, China allowing that, that suggests that China, in some sense, is actually starting to accommodate.
The Chinese Coast Guard effectively controls access to Scarborough Shoal, although both countries claim it. That control has angered a large, struggling fishing population in the Philippines, just 220 kilometers from the shoal, closer to the fishing grounds than the nearest part of China. The shoal lies within the Philippines' 370-kilometer exclusive economic zone, but China is militarily stronger than the Philippines, deterring any pushback. Jonathan Spangler, director of the South China Sea think tank in Taipei, says giving Philippine fishermen access defers criticism in the short term.
Even the most minimal gestures of goodwill towards other countries, such as allowing Philippine fishermen into Scarborough Shoal, are enough to appease critics or at least defer criticism for the time being.
China claims about 90% of the sea, extending south from its coastline over to the Philippines and into the claims of Brunei, Malaysia, Vietnam, and Taiwan. It points to historic records as a license to use those waters. Since the World Court ruling, China has tried to get along with other rival maritime claimants as well as the Philippines without accepting the verdict itself. Maria Ella Atienza, political science professor at University of the Philippines Diliman, says some people already think China should do more than letting Philippine vessels into the shoal as it sees fit.
They said that the Chinese authorities allowed them, but there are people who say, why would they allow them? These are areas that are supposed to be, if not Philippine territories, it should be shared openly.
Beijing has alarmed other countries by letting Coast Guard vessels operate in disputed waters and by building artificial islands, some for deployments of radar systems and combat aircraft. China agreed earlier this month with 10 Southeast Asian nations to a maritime code of conduct framework aimed at preventing accidents in the disputed sea. Our thanks to Ralph Jennings in Taipei for sending us this report. Happening now in Asia, in India, controversial guru Gurmeet Ram Rahim Singh has been sentenced to 2 10-year concurrent prison sentences for raping two of his female followers. Roads were lined with barbed wire and soldiers to avoid a repeat of the rampaging that left 38 people dead after Singh was convicted last Friday. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad to have you with us today on VOA Asia. Thanks for listening. The U.S. Navy said it has recovered the remains of 10 sailors who were killed last week in the latest accident involving a U.S. warship this year. The guided missile destroyer John S. McCain collided with a Liberian-flagged oil tanker at the entrance to the Strait of Malacca, one of the busiest shipping lanes in the world. The incident remains under investigation. A fleet-wide review of seamanship is now underway. The damaged McCain, now docked in Singapore, is part of the nearly 70-ship 7th Fleet based in Japan. Brad Glosserman, executive director of the defensive think tank Pacific Forum, tells VOA this fourth such mishap this year is not just an embarrassment for the Navy, it's a cause of concern.
There have been two Aegis-class or Arleigh Burke destroyers that have been involved. The Fitzgerald was in June. The McCain, as you noted, was in August. Earlier this year, a Ticonderoga-class cruiser had an accident with a South Korean fishing boat when it was operating with the USSS Carl Vinson Strike Group, and then a fourth vessel actually ran aground in Tokyo Bay at the beginning of the year. This many accidents for one fleet suggests that there are some serious problems with Navy procedures or Navy training or something, and thus there needs to be some attention paid to what's going on and figuring out the problem and fixing it. The problem is actually fairly simple, and that is that we've acknowledged that the Asia-Pacific theater is of vast, extraordinary importance and growing importance, and we need to be devoting more resources, as President Obama outlined with his rebalance. We have crisis in North Korea. We have the ongoing assertion of the territorial authority by the Chinese government in the South China Sea. We have terrorist operations in Southeast Asia. Meanwhile, wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, special operations elsewhere in the world. I would note that I'm sure the Voice of America has pointed out that there have been some helicopter accidents. It's just extraordinarily high-paced tempo and operations. Our resources are stretched. Our crews are probably not getting the rest or the training that they need. And as a result, we have accidents.
Brad Glosserman warned that such accidents may embolden potential adversaries to miscalculate raising the specter of conflict and outlines of some what issues might be under review.
First of all, the CNO, the Chief of Naval Operations, called for a 24-hour stand-down, which meant that ships all over the world would take 24 hours, not all at the same time, to review procedures, figure out what's going on, and just sort of take stock of where they are. And then there's been the commander of fleet operations has been tasked with a review of what's going on with the 7th Fleet. And so hopefully we'll get some better idea of what exactly the problem is and how best to remedy it.
Illinois Republican Congressman Adam Kinzinger, an Air Force veteran, told CNN the Navy is probably approaching a readiness crisis. He said in many cases you have a Navy that is highly operational and may not get the time or the chance to train as deeply or as much as they want. He also blamed old and failing equipment. You're listening to VOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This news alert from VOA Asia, an attorney for Samsung Vice Chairman Yi Jae-young filed an appeal in the bribery case for which Yi was sentenced last week to 5 years in prison. The Seoul Central District Court also found him guilty of financial crimes. He has denied any wrongdoing. All the big stories come your way throughout the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. As we continue with VOA Asia, Pakistan appears to have hardened its stance to U.S. President Donald Trump's recently announced Afghan and South Asia strategy. But officials dismiss suggestions Islamabad is seeking confrontation or a rupture in its decades-old relations with Washington. While announcing his long-awaited policy last week, Trump accused Pakistan of housing agents of chaos and the very terrorists the U.S. military has been battling in Afghanistan. The policy also attempts to give Pakistan's arch-rival India a major role in security-related regional efforts. Pakistani leaders responded by saying the U.S. terror charges are an attempt to scapegoat the country and accuse the American military of failing to defeat the 16-year-old Afghan Taliban insurgency. Pakistani Senator Mujahideen Hussein says instead of acknowledging Pakistan's unprecedented sacrifices in fighting terrorism, Washington's new Afghan strategy is nothing but the same old tactics of bullying and browbeating.
That's why Pakistan has said very clearly neither the foreign minister is going to Washington nor are we willing to receive any American delegation to Islamabad.
The influential Pakistani senator emphasized the importance of engagement between the two countries, saying only through collective efforts, also involving key regional stakeholders, can the long-standing Afghan problem be resolved.
I think the best way forward would be for the United States administration to review its wrong policy, not place blame on Pakistan, and consider Pakistan as part of the solution rather than part of the problem, and not look at the issue and the region through the lenses of India.
Suspicion in Washington about Islamabad's efforts against terrorism stemmed from the killing of al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden by U.S. forces deep inside Pakistan in 2011 and the elimination of Taliban chief Mullah Akhtar Mansour in a U.S. drone strike in the country's southwest in 2016. Pakistani officials cite the U.S. military's assessments of the Taliban has extended its control or influence to more than 40% of the Afghan territory since the withdrawal of international combat forces from Afghanistan in 2014. Pakistan has long ignored U.S. and Afghan demands to use force against Taliban insurgents hiding on its soil. Officials maintain millions of Afghan refugees are in the country, and it is impossible for authorities to identify suspected militants who are using the displaced population for shelter. Pakistani officials say the fencing of a nearly 2,600-kilometer largely porous border with Afghanistan and building new forts as well as outposts will effectively deter terrorism infiltration. Despite financial and logistical challenges, the massive project is expected to be completed within the next 2 years, according to an army spokesman. Officials in Islamabad have shown concern about possible U.S. military and economic sanctions in the Trump administration's new Afghan policy, citing years of dependence on American military hardware and the United States being a major trade partner. They do not, however, anticipate a, quote, rupture in bilateral ties, as Pakistan's ground lines of communication and airspace continue to play a crucial role in sending supplies to thousands of American and NATO troops in Afghanistan. Observers say Pakistan's deepening relations with traditional ally China and emerging alliance with Russia have apparently emboldened Islamabad to say enough is enough to U.S. pressure tactics. We thank Ayaz Ghul in Islamabad for sending us this story. This news alert from VOA Asia. India says it reached an agreement with China to pull back troops from a disputed border area that has been the subject of a standoff dating back to June. India's foreign ministry says the two governments agreed to expeditious disengagement of personnel from the area after weeks of diplomatic exchanges. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, President Trump proposes to make big cuts in spending on global health research that could affect work to end malaria, AIDS, and protect against other infectious diseases. Carol Pearson reports that although the president's proposal is essentially a wish list and Congress does not have to go along with it, some see it as part of a disturbing trend.
When the Ebola crisis erupted in 2014, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention sent staff to help West African countries contain the pandemic. The National Institutes of Health funded research and supported pharmaceutical giants to produce a vaccine that would not be profitable. NIH has also been instrumental in the fight against AIDS and malaria. AIDS deaths are now close to half of what they were in 2005, according to the UN AIDS Agency, and researchers seem to be closing in on a malaria vaccine. President Trump's proposed 2018 budget calls for an 18% funding cut for NIH and a 17% cut for the CDC. Stephen Morrison heads the Global Health Policy Center at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
If these cuts as proposed were enacted, it would have severe impact on health security.
And it's far cheaper to be ready for a disease outbreak than to fight one once it starts, notes Jamie Bay-Nishi with the Global Health Technologies Coalition.
the National Academy of Medicine put out a report estimating that responding to a pandemic threat costs $60 billion, but ongoing investment in preventative research to try and mitigate against a future threat is $1 billion per year.
Nishi says U.S. investments have produced malaria drugs that have saved 750,000 lives and an inexpensive meningitis vaccine that has prevented nearly 400,000 deaths. In addition, large pharmaceutical companies like Johnson & Johnson need the government to back research, especially for drugs for low-income countries. Jamie Taylor is with Johnson & Johnson.
We cannot do it on our own, and that's definitive.
Morrison says the president's budget request isn't a done deal.
He's not going to get all that he wants, but he's going to get something.
The main problem, as Morrison and others see it, is if budget cuts continue, the U.S. will lose its position as a world leader in medical research, and the world would be more vulnerable to the spread of infectious disease. Elizabeth Cameron from the Nuclear Threat Initiative says bioterrorism could become a greater risk to the U.S.
Absolutely vital that we get to a point where we're able to respond to any disease threat that comes our way, no matter how it comes our way.
And finally, Nishi argues that U.S. research and development creates jobs that would be lost by budget cuts.
U.S. government investments in global health R&D not only save millions of lives around the world, but they support U.S. jobs, U.S. economy, and U.S. health security.
But the Secretary of the Health and Human Services Department, Dr. Tom Price, says if both agencies cut administrative costs, they won't lose programs.
And I think what the budget is trying to do is to, being the first step in this process, is trying to bring focus to the kinds of things that we ought to be able to do to get a bigger bang for our buck.
Congress will tackle these issues when the lawmakers return from their summer recess in September. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
If you visited a Starbucks coffee shop recently, you may have been able to access some of the fastest Wi-Fi that us regular folks can enjoy, a blazing 9 megabytes per second. VOA's Kevin Enix reports researchers in the Netherlands, though, have found some Wi-Fi that leaves that in the dust.
The Wi-Fi you and I use operates using radio waves, and that's a problem because everyone on the network is sharing the bandwidth.
The problem with current Wi-Fi networks is actually that you have just a single antenna in your room, or actually in your whole building, which tries to cover the whole building. That means that everybody inside that building needs to get access to that single antenna, so you need to share it.
But this new system uses individual beams of light from a receiver in the room. The beams are so focused, you can cut off the signal just by placing your hand in its path. But that signal is all yours. No sharing.
This wavelength has a particular position where the receiver is located. So if we wanted to move our user in another position on the table, we need to send another wavelength to reach that user.
Each individual beam of light is a network.
Well, what we develop here is to get an alternative for Wi-Fi. So what we are doing actually is using rays of light, which convey the information in a wireless way. And each ray is acting as a very high capacity channel. It's actually the same as an optical fiber without needing the fiber.
And that means speeds of up to 300 times faster than current Wi-Fi.
What we achieved up to this moment is 112 gigabits per second. That's actually speed if you try to compare it to daily use. That's where you have a DVD disc, for instance, with a high-quality video on it, which roughly has 5 gigabytes of information, which means 40 gigabits. So we almost transmit 3 of these DVDs within a second, within a single beam of light.
The system is cheap and more secure than Wi-Fi because the light beams are so focused, no one can hack into your network. The researchers say they expect the technology to be widespread within 5 years. For writer Kevin Enox, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia, and we invite you to stay with VOA all day as more information comes in on the latest North Korean missile launch. You can also find us on Facebook at VOA Asia, and you can send us a message there or write to us at voaasia@voanews.com. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Daryl Smith, managing editor Diane Gao, David Bird and Ali Ogden on our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We hope you have a great day ahead.